Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join me today. I am delighted to welcome my old friend, Peter Wehner, who is with the Trinity Forum and also a contributor to the New York Times and the Atlantic. So it is always a thrill to talk to Pete. And thank you for joining me today.
It's great to be with you, Mona. I always enjoy the conversations.
I want to start with a piece that you did in The Atlantic about what we have learned from what happened in Minneapolis. And but before we get to that, I just want to set the stage a little bit so that people, whom there may be people out there who don't know this about you, but you worked for President George W. Bush.
On it.
And you were very involved behind the scenes in the effort to create PEPFAR. So if you could just give us a quick reminder of what PEPFAR was, how it came to be, and what the motivation for it was in the Bush White House.
Sure. No, I'm happy to do that. What was happening is that in the late 1990s, AIDS was ravaging the African continent. Some countries in particular, they were just breaking apart. It wasn't just the deaths that were piling up, but the governing capacity of some of these countries was being crippled. So this was a real crisis, humanitarian crisis, to some extent a geopolitical crisis, or at least a real challenge. President Bush came into office, and early in his first term, he learned about this, this crisis that was unfolding, and wanted to do something about it. And he assembled a team at the White House and some figures over at the National Institutes of Health at NIH. It's primarily Anthony Fauci and Mark Dybul, who was working for Tony at the time. And within the White House, Josh Bolten, who was deputy chief of staff to the president at the time, and he had a team, Kristen Silverberg among them. Mike Gerson, who was my closest friend at the time and the chief speechwriter and advisor to President Bush, Jay Lefkowitz. Connie Rice, who was NSC advisor, Colin Powell, who was Secretary of State, and others. And this was a pretty close hold initiative. The reason, as you know, having worked in the Reagan administration, is sometimes bureaucracies can throw sand in the gears of any important initiative. And so that's what they're for, exactly. It's why they exist. And so this was kind of pushed through, and it was not an easy effort. It wasn't actually even entirely clear what approach that should be taken. But to make a long story short, working with Fauci and Mark Dybul, came up with a program, instituted it, asked for $15 billion, which was far and away a record for a single disease at that time, announced it in the 2003 State of the Union Address. And over the next years, up until today, their estimates are that 26 million lives in the African continent are alive because of the Global AIDS Initiative. PEPFAR is the acronym. And I think it's one of the great humanitarian achievements in American history. And as I said, I think it had important global geostrategic implications as well. And up until the Trump administration, it had full bipartisan support, and nobody really had anything critical to say about PEPFAR. As far as a government program ran, it was quite accountable and quite effective.
I think Churchill said about the Marshall Plan that it was like the most unsorted act in right. world history, or words to that effect. He didn't live long enough to see PEPFAR, but mm-hmm. I think that yes. description fits PEPFAR even better. So with the cuts or decimation of USAID, how much of PEPFAR still exists?
It still exists, but it's been crippled. It was a huge blow. When USAID was shuttered, which was a year ago, just about a year ago when the executive order was signed by President Trump, that just did incalculable damage because USAID was the implementing agency for PEPFAR. And that took a lot of time. I mean, it took years to build up the infrastructure. So the drugs, getting facilities on the ground that can treat patients, that can get the drugs out, storing the drugs, all of that is complicated logistical matter.
Some of them need to be kept at certain temperatures, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in storage units. And then there are the doctors on the ground in various cities and towns and rural areas. And they're paid almost nothing at all, but they were being paid something. So when USAID was shuttered, that infrastructure began to break apart. And so PEPFAR is still up and running, but it's badly, badly damaged. And the administration and Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, has done almost nothing to try and resuscitate it. And it's come at a tremendous human cost.
Some of the victims have been mothers and infants. So do you have some numbers on the estimates of how many adults and children have died since Elon Musk wielded his chainsaw?
There's something called the PEPFAR impact counter, which keeps a running tab of these things. And the latest figures that I've seen is about 165,000 adult deaths and about more than 17,000 child deaths that have occurred. It's just so, it's tragic, obviously, but it's just so unnecessary.
Right.
That DOGE effort did virtually nothing to save any money, which was its ostensible reason to survive. And in a way, we got the worst of all worlds with DOGE, which is it really didn't do anything to help savings, but it destroyed or decimated or badly damaged a few very key institutions. National Institutes of Health was one of them, but USAID and PEPFAR were two that are right at the top of the list. And they seem utterly unmoved by it. Of course, this is an administration filled with cruel and in some cases wicked people. So morality doesn't reach them. But having this kind of human catastrophe, and again, having it happen based on a program that was so widely respected and so widely supported, there's a kind of nihilism in it. And nihilism isn't just an abstract problem. Nihilism is a problem when it touches human lives.
You know, because this administration is such a tornado of outrage and destruction, one of the challenges is to even keep track of and try to hold people accountable for the evil that they're doing. And this is one where in a normal world, in a normal administration, this would be a huge scandal. There would be tremendous shame associated with having caused the unnecessary deaths. I mean, even if you believed that, USAID was full of woke people and it was funding too many, gay plays or something. I don't know what they thought,
right.
But maybe that was, I've heard rumors that that's some of what they were complaining about. Even if you thought that, there was a way that any rational, reasonable person would try to scale it back. First of all, they'd start with the offensive stuff that they didn't like, and they'd say, okay, we're not going to do plays anymore, whatever
right.
it is, right?
Right.
And then also you would not, in the middle of a program that people rely on for their very lives, simply shut it down, close the facilities where the medicines were being kept. It's so evil that it is a bit mind-boggling. And so anyway, I just wanted to dwell on that for a minute. And it's worth noting that this was a humanitarian program, something that did make Americans proud of our world role and also earned us friends in a very important part of the world. But that was begun and initiated by a Republican administration And I'm at pains to say that, Pete, because I'm sure you get this all the time. I know I still get it, which is, you know, you Republicans, you brought us this, you know, the Trump administration is just the culmination of everything you've always been right. and believed. And, you know, I will go to my grave saying no. I mean, right. it's absolute, that's a calumny. It is so not true.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point, Mona. I agree with you. The way I think about it is, you know, that there were elements, impulses on the American right, which were dark. That was news to us. And we saw it in figures, you know, going back to the John Birch Society, William F. Buckley, when he expelled them, to Pat Buchanan and his various strains of anti-Semitism, and really was, I think, almost an intellectual precursor to the MAGA movement, to the extent that MAGA has any kind of intellectual basis. It's just someone like Buchanan was there. So look, there were elements of that, just like there are elements in the Democratic Party, which have come to the fore in recent years and recent decades, too. So that's not news. I think what we felt at the time was that you had leaders, including presidents, whether it was Reagan or the two Bushes or others, who would speak out at appropriate moments against those darker impulses, those darker forces, tried to keep them on the fringe. And to varying degrees and with varying degrees of success, you know, tried to champion and put forward, you know, programs that were humane and promoted the human good. Nobody does that perfectly of either administration. Life is
Absolutely.
Complicated. Government is and governing is complicated. What's notable? Well, there's so many things that are notable about the Trump era, but to me, it was such a fundamental break with conservatism, not just the Republican Party, because I consider it in many respects antithetical to conservatism. And I don't refer to what is happening today as sort of the conservative movement. I think it's a reactionary right. It's populist.
Yes.
And the best of conservatism is actually contrary in so many fundamental ways to what's happening. So conservatism does not have a political home currently.
That is so, I mean, since you mentioned it, I'm going to pull this sheet of paper out that I this was on another topic entirely. I wasn't even planning to talk about this, but I happen to just be jotting down, like, what is left of conservatism, you know, in this era. And so I ticked them off. So free trade, well, it's gone. Reduced regulation. That's
just
maybe.
So you know, there's a freeze.
But in all the wrong ways, because it's a kleptocracy. So reduced regulation for some, more for others, and also corrupt use of the regulatory state. So I'm going to take that one off and say that's gone. Manners and morals. That was something that we took seriously as conservatives. Fiscal discipline. All right. That was more honored in the breach than the observance, but at least there was some lip service given to it. Not even that anymore. World leadership, standing for liberty, adherence to the Constitution, suspicion about overweening government power, respect for law and procedure, market-oriented solutions to various problems, including climate change, education reform, welcoming to immigrants. What's left?
Yeah, that's a great list. That's a great list. It's interesting that you mentioned that, because I think about conservatism on three levels. I think about sort of dispositional or temperamental conservatism. Then I think about philosophical conservatism, limited government. And then I think about the policies, taxes, welfare, education, American leadership in the world. And I think if you go through each of those, conservatism as we understood it, or conservatism as articulated, you know, by Burke or Oakeshott, I mean, there are various figures who shaped conservatism, including in America, obviously. What the Republican Party stands for, what MAGA movement stands for, is just contrary to those things, whether it's the rule of law and limited government, whether it has to do with any number of policies that you've listed, including free trade and free markets. And then this dispositional side, this idea of the importance of manners and morals, epistemic humility, the importance of human experience, modesty and what the aims of government are going to be. And this issue that was so important during the time in which, you know, we were shaped, which was civility, virtue, morality.
Yes.
If you go back to The Closing of the American Mind, which was such a significant book in the late 80s, I think it was 1987, mm-hmm. Alan Bloom, then a professor at University of Chicago, wrote that book, which was a real indictment, as you'll recall, on the academy. And I think it was one of the opening sentences in the book where Bloom said that, you know, the one thing you can be sure of if you're talking to college students at elite universities is relativism.
Yes.
And so his book was a very deep articulation of the case for enduring moral values, ideals, and, you know, it explored Nietzsche and a lot of other stuff. Well, now you have a movement and a leader in Donald Trump, which has fully embraced nihilism and relativism in a way that leaves the left in the dust. So to see that kind of a change is pretty disorienting, but needs to be named.
Yeah, it absolutely does. So political progress is a battle of inches, especially in a country like ours that's so polarized. And so if certain numbers of people in the other coalition can be peeled off, that's the ball game. And so but in order to get there, I think it's helpful, and I think you're a great person to help analyze this. It's helpful to look at what the MAGA people believe. I mean, it's kind of a base assumption of mine, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think that there are certain people in the world who embrace wickedness and who think that it's strength, and they praise it, and they're proud of it, and they're bad people, and they're proud of being bad.
Right.
There are some like that. Plenty of them represented in this White House. But most people are not like that. Most people want to believe that what they are doing is either defensive, it's only because they're being attacked that they're lashing out, or that they're really really the virtuous ones. And so I suspect that, like, I'm writing today about this whole immigration thing, and I think that when you look at the polling, you see that there's a huge distinction that MAGA people make between legal and illegal immigration. They're actually not against legal immigration, but they are adamantly against illegal immigration. And that's partly, as Jonathan Haidt has taught us, you know, because of there are certain things they hold sacred, you know, following the rules and doing things. So there's that. And so they don't like rule breakers. But the other part of it is, I think that they have been persuaded of a lot of things that just ain't true. They think that all these illegals are coming across the border and getting all kinds of benefits from the government and are committing huge amounts of crime. And so that's their assumption, their wrong belief, and it affects how they view what's happening now. So I'd like to get your views on, first of all, do you agree that that's how they perceive the immigration issue, or some others too? What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're onto something important. I mean, you're right. There are some figures who are, you know, wicked all the way through, and they, for them, doing acts of dehumanization is a kind of vivifying thing. It gives purpose to their life. There's something obviously morally distorted and probably psychologically distorted in these kinds of people, but doing harm for harm's sake seems to be life-giving to them. I would say somebody like Stephen Miller, I don't know him, but from a distance and from people who do know him and observed him, I would say that he is a kind of figure like that. I'd say Donald Trump is very much that kind of a figure. So they belong in one category. They obviously can't be reasoned with. And when dealing with people who are, the case of Trump, I would say sociopathic, you know, that's a real challenge. I mean, if you read the literature on this, we're just not used to dealing with people in everyday life like that. So the assumptions that you bring into normal human relationships don't always apply. But in general, I would say that what you described is right. I don't think that a lot of the people who are supporters of Donald Trump and the MAGA movement fall into that category. I think what they are doing is they're supporting a person in a movement that's doing awful and in cases, evil things. But I also believe that most people don't live easily with cognitive dissonance, that it's the notion that you can live at odds with who you believe yourself to be. It just creates too much psychological pain and conflict. And the mind knows that. And so the mind has the capacity to justify and rationalize an enormous amount. And I'm sure you can think of people that you've met in your personal life over the years who have lived a life that is at odds with what they said they were, what they thought themselves to be, what others thought themselves to be. And the question is, how'd you do this? How did you get away with this? And the answer is a series of rationalizations and justifications. In the case of MAGA and the political movement, I'd say several things have happened. And this is true on immigration, but it applies to other issues too. One is that they dilute the awfulness of what Donald Trump is doing. So it's the mean tweet is a phrase that was used. So they say, okay, he says things that are a little rough around the edges. I mean, that was what was said kind of early on. But you have to mitigate what he does that's awful. Then you have to elevate the threat of the other side. You have to turn it into an existential struggle. So when Donald Trump crosses ethical and moral lines, that you do what you have to do because there's so much at stake. If the Nazis knock on the door and ask if you're hiding somebody who's Jewish, you lie and you said, no, I'm not, but you're doing it for a greater good. So in their worldview, the left, the Democratic Party, is about to destroy America, everything you know and love and cherish, including your children. They have to be stopped, even if the means that you have to use is at times distasteful. And then you have this issue of the propaganda and the capacity that people have now through the internet and all of the changes we've seen in social media to validate in their minds any claim that's made. We saw that in the lies about the 2020 election or during COVID, you know, that hydroxychloroquine could cure COVID. That there was no basis for that, but you could go to some crank websites and hear, you know, a registered nurse make a case in a slick 25-minute video, and that would be enough. So there you have it. You have medical evidence. So I think all of those things are happening. And so when you engage with people in that movement and you make arguments that are contrary to the facts they hold or the beliefs they hold, you see what happens, which is the stronger your case is, the angrier they get and the more willing they are to lash out. Why does that happen? Because they hold these views for reasons that they're not aware of. It's not that they made a rational determination that this is the case. It's, this is what I believe. It's core to my identity. And the weaker their case, the more dug in they get and the more they're likely they are to lash out because they're being exposed for saying, I don't care what your facts are. What I believe is true, get off my back. So it's mm-hmm. a complicated psychological dance that happens.
So for many years, you still call yourself a Christian. I think for years you called yourself an evangelical, but you're backing away from that, I guess, yeah. because of the implications of, or yeah. the associations with the Trumpism. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay. So among evangelicals and people of that ilk, can you be more specific about what they think the left is going to do? Because, you know, from one point of view, if you look at the law these days, we have never had a legal regime in American history that was more friendly to religious expression.
Right.
There are all kinds of Supreme Court decisions and statutes on the book to prevent people from disrupting religious services or impeding in any way your religious expression and so on. So what do they think the left is going to do to their religion, for example, because they do think their religion is in danger, right?
Yes, they do. And it's an important point. It's not limited to that either. So I'll disaggregate that a little bit. Yeah, what they think, and it, you know, this the unbelievably shallow manifestation of this, but it does say something, was, you know, when for years Trump would say, you could say Merry Christmas again, you know, if you go into a, you know, a Best Buy or a Walmart or something ludicrous like that. And so there is a sense in which they think that the state is going to cripple their faith and their churches. COVID played into that to some extent when we had the lockdowns and the shutdowns, and there were certain right-wing churches that refused to close. Somebody like a John MacArthur on the West Coast, who's a significant figure in the fundamentalist evangelical world. So that played into it. But you're quite right. And David French, our mutual friend, has written about it, a lawyer, an expert actually in this area. And there's probably mm-hmm. never been a period in American history where there have been more protections for religious liberty than exist today. And I've said to friends of mine who are Christians that, you know, if you wanted to choose any period of time in any country in the history of Christianity in which you would have it better on the ground in the reality, it'd be hard to choose a country or a time other than America in 2026. And yet to take that and to speak as if this is persecution comparable to Nero is just insane. But it's important because they have to feel that they're under attack. Beyond that, if you said, okay, well, let's widen the aperture away from attacks on religion, then there's the issue of what they'll do to the culture, right? So a lot of mm-hmm. evangelicals are cultural conservatives. And I would say on the sort of order of the concerns, they would have very high up a couple of traditional issues, and that would be abortion and sexual ethics.
Sorry.
Yes. Now I know it does raise some obvious problems. On the abortion issue, I mean, this is really quite interesting. If you look over the last 35 or 40 years at the number of abortions, they have gone down most dramatically during Democratic, not Republican administrations. And the lowest number of abortions, both rate, ratio, total number, since 1980 or even the 1970s, was at the end of Barack Obama's second term. Now, I'm not saying cause and effect,
right?
But there are issues. It gets complicated in terms of contraception and so forth. But in any event, the numbers indicate that having a Democratic president, administration, and even a Supreme Court did not lead to massive increase in abortions, but actually the opposite. When did abortions begin to go up? Donald Trump, his first term, they went up 7%, and they've gone up, since then. So even on the issue of abortion, which some of them would say is primus inter pares, it's the first among equals, is it that you care about the issue or is it that you care about the number of abortions? I think what has happened is for a lot of them, it's become
the issue. Or they just care about the rhetoric.
Exactly. And to say that they're pro-life. And then beyond that, they would say
we should say they're pro-life talk.
Yeah.
Not their pro-life.
Yes. And their pro-life talk before birth. To paraphrase what Barney Frank, I think, once said.
This episode of the Mona Charon Show is brought to you by Wild Grain. Wild Grain is the first bake from frozen subscription box for sourdough breads, artisanal pastries, and fresh pastas. Plus, all items conveniently bake in 25 minutes or less. Unlike many store-bought options, Wild Grain uses simple ingredients you can pronounce and a slow fermentation process that can be easier on your belly and richer in nutrients and antioxidants. There are no preservatives and no shortcuts. Wild Grain's boxes are fully customizable. In addition to their variety box, they have a gluten-free box, a vegan box, and a new protein box. I love getting the croissants. Honestly, I make my own bread sometimes, but I have never been able to master the croissant. But it comes, you know, frozen, and you just pop it in the oven, and it fills your kitchen with the most amazing aroma. People sort of let their noses guide them to the kitchen. What's that? What have you got there? Well, it's croissant. So you also get the convenience of delivery. And as I mentioned, they bake in under 25 minutes. So you will be the hero of your house. There's nothing like having an artisan bakery in your freezer to chase away the winter chill. Now is the best time to stay in and enjoy comforting homemade meals with Wild Grain. Right now, Wild Grain is offering our listeners $30 off your first box, plus free croissants for life when you go to wildgrain.com/Mona to start your subscription today. That's $30 off your first box and free croissants for life. That's $30 off your first box and free croissants for life. Yep. When you visit wildgrain.com/Mona, or you can use the promo code Mona at checkout.
Look, you know, as a person of the Christian faith, that's been probably the most painful thing that's happened in this era, which is the degree to which the evangelical and the fundamentalist movement have rallied behind Donald Trump. And I would say what's happened is, if you looked over the sort of 10-year arc, what was viewed as a bug about Donald Trump became a feature. That is, his immorality, his cruelty, his dehumanization. I don't think they were wild about that at the time. And I remember conversations with people who were uneasy about him, although they would always put in a caveat, which is he's our warrior, he's our fighter. So I heard a version that Reagan and the two Bushes were certainly better human beings than Donald Trump, but they were too genteel. They didn't understand that the
what
other
we're
team,
up against.
Exactly. The other side is cheating, and we can't play by the rules, and Donald Trump doesn't play by the rules. So, you know, God bless him. He's
I know. And I've also seen them refer to King David, you know, well, he wasn't perfect, you know, but boy, he was what we needed. And
exactly. And Cyrus, right. He's our Cyrus, who was so important in Jewish history, but who was not a Jewish Persian. So that has happened. And I do think what's gone on is that, as Christians and non-Christians too, but here we're talking about people of a Christian faith, have made one accommodation after another. It just became easier and easier for them to do it. And that they themselves found that the kind of the dark passions that were stirred up were kind of life-giving to them. I think it gave them, to some extent, a purpose in life. They felt like they became heroes in this sort of self-created drama that people are susceptible to, but the net effect is kind of an incalculable damage, I'd say, to the Christian witness and to the civic condition of the country.
So one of the things that was revealed, this isn't new, but there was more of it in the latest tranche of Epstein documents. One thing that struck me is, you know, there are millions of people. One of them was Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is no longer part of the MAGA coalition, having become disillusioned. But she first became illusioned by QAnon.
Right, exactly.
And she's one of millions. And the QAnon message was that there is a cabal of powerful men who are abusing children, girls, and boys, who knows, and that Donald Trump was going to be the savior who was going to ride in and reveal all this and so on. And so these files reveal very clearly that Steve Bannon was helping Jeffrey Epstein with his image problems. They were planning on releasing all kinds of propaganda to clean up Epstein's image. You would think that if those people were sincere about believing that they want to uncover the evil doings of the cabal of powerful men, that Steve Bannon would lose his standing in that crowd, that he would be shamed and shunned. And nothing like that has happened.
Yeah. Yeah, that is exactly right. And there's a whole slew of them, including, at least to varying degrees, you know, the president of the United States. You would think that would happen, but you'd only think it would happen if these people were morally serious. And if what they said was driving them was actually driving them. And I should say something here, because I don't mean to say that for all of these people that they were cynical at the time. I think that various people believed what they said at the time, at least on some level. And so they probably did talk themselves up into a fury. But what was really underneath that, I think what was underneath that was the idea that this immorality is being done by them, not by us. And this is a trap for them. And you see this all the time, Mona, in when people die, like if an individual is killed or there's a massacre, what's the first thing a lot of people think? They think, well, who did it? And can this promote my cause? I sure hope it was a leftist that that pulled the trigger or did the killing.
Or a Muslim.
Exactly, or a Muslim. Because that fits into our narrative. And then they go to town. If it doesn't fit into their narrative, they look the other way. And what does that tell us? It doesn't say that those concerns are utterly invalid, they don't exist, but it says there's something deeper going on. And it is that people and issues become pawns in a kind of political cultural identity game. And
even
murder. And so in this case, you know, Steve Bannon, who's obviously a really nasty piece of work, and here he is, trying to help Epstein in terms of his PR and all the rest. And as you say, he's got huge amount of cachet within the MAGA world. There's nothing that could come out that would weaken him. But we've tested that proposition time and time again with Donald Trump, who's done the most awful things imaginable.
That's right.
And you see it, as you well know, there are people like Al Mohler and others in the Christian right who would go after Bill Clinton with a figurative 2x4 every other day in 1998 over the Lewinsky scandal. And Al Mohler is now essentially a walking talking point for Donald Trump. And he will defend whatever Trump does with almost no exceptions. Mohler said in 2016, he couldn't vote for Donald Trump because if he did, he'd have to send a note of apology to Bill Clinton. Well, he voted publicly. He stated he voted for Trump in 2020 and he voted for him again in 2024. I don't think they'll never receive that note of apology. but Al Mohler is now out there doing his work. Eric Metaxas is doing the work. Robert Jeffress is doing the work. Franklin Graham is doing the work. You just go down the list.
Yeah. One thing that has been driven home in this era where we are governed by probably the greatest con man of all time, is that something that people who study cults and other things have known for a very long time, which is it is far easier to con someone than to convince them that they have been conned.
Exactly. That's a good point.
Because there's too much shame associated with admitting you were had.
Right.
And so people get dug in. Now, that much having been said, I mentioned a while ago in our conversation that politics is a game of inches. So what we have been discussing is the diehards. We've been talking about the real MAGA cult that does not represent the whole Republican Party, and it doesn't, and certainly doesn't represent the whole coalition of people who put Trump in the White House in 2024.
Right.
That was a group that included the diehards. It also included the sort of just loosely affiliated Republicans who always vote Republican. It included a bunch of independents who felt that this was the lesser of two evils. And that is where our only hope lies, is that those people can be disabused, those people can be peeled away because they don't have that emotional investment in Trump, right? And so let's talk about your piece about what's happening in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
Because you think there are reasons for at least some hope about what's happening there.
Yeah, sure. I did a piece in the Atlantic, which I said, you know, one thing was confirmed, and then there were two areas of encouragement. The thing that was confirmed was just the cruelty of the administration, and it was not only that they gave the green light to what's essentially a paramilitary force in Minneapolis, and then when Rebecca Good and Alex Pretty were killed, that they immediately went on the air and told lies about the conditions of that. But then they went on to defame that those individuals as well, accusing them of domestic terrorism and all sorts of other awful things. So in that respect, we didn't learn anything new. It was just confirmed that the dehumanization machine in the White House is alive and well. That was driven by Kristi Noem, but particularly, again, by Stephen Miller. Having said that, there were two areas that I took some measure of comfort from. The first is that the gaslighting that the administration was doing didn't work. In this case, who are you going to believe, your lying eyes or me? In this case, people believe what they saw, and it helped. I think with there were a number of different iPhone filming and different angles of what happened. So there was clear empirical evidence of what happened. But the administration's effort to try and promote the lie, to tell people that what they saw wasn't reality, actually failed. Now, there's an important caveat that I think needs to be added to this, and that's that Donald Trump himself did not get behind that gaslighting effort. He was somewhat distant from it, so it was mostly his lackeys who were promoting that.
I think he got into it a little bit, Pete. I mean, he did say something about Alex Pretty being a radical and the spitting on the van or something. He did get into it a little bit, I think.
Yes, you know, he has. Some of that has been a little bit later, but it was not with the force, for example, of the 2020 election.
No, that's true.
And even if he had, it may not have worked. So it is important that after 10 years in which the sort of gaslighting effort, this distortion of reality has worked, and we can go through a whole list of things. In this case, it didn't. There were a lot of people, including within the Republican world, that were really uneasy with what happened. And they were very early on sort of saying, we've got to distance ourselves from this. I think Eric Erickson, you know, may have been one figure who's a traditional Trump supporter, and others who've done it.
Yeah, there were half a dozen Republican senators.
Exactly. So that was good. I mean, we'll take those things where you can get it. I'd say the deeper and more encouraging sign was that standing up in the way that the courageous people of Minneapolis did, the way that they protested, the public uprising did work. They're backing down. The Trump administration is backing down. They're backing away from the number of troops that they're sending into the streets. And they know that this was a loss. Trump knew it was a loss. They obviously, cut Kristi Noem off at the knees and replaced that Gestapo-like figure that was running around the streets.
Greg Bovino.
Yeah, Greg Bovino. And that is really important because it shows, there's a book called Why Civil Resistance Works. It's by Erica Chenoweth and Maria Steffen. And it's on the strategic logic of nonviolence conflict, and it's an analysis of how civil resistance has worked throughout countries in the world. It's sort of a case study. And it does work. And, you know, if you have a variety of levers that you can pull, lawsuits, mass rallies, strikes, work slowdown, boycotts, those kinds of things, those can bring authoritarian regimes to their knees. It has to be coordinated. If you do this episodically, you've seen this in a sense when individuals stand up to Donald Trump, they can pick those individuals off. But if groups, organizations, institutions can join together in a show of resistance, that actually can have some effect. We saw it also in the international sphere when Europe stood up to Trump on Greenland. They sent tripwires to Greenland. They sent out mm-hmm. statements. They said Article mm-hmm. 5 is in effect. What mm-hmm. happened? Trump backed down.
Yep.
So I think what we've seen at various moments in the Trump era, that they and he will back down if the resistance is strong enough. And in Minneapolis, something happened that triggered something in a lot of people, including these people you were identifying, independents, others, may have voted for Trump, but said, look, we didn't vote for this, and this is a bridge too far. You can't be killing people in the streets. And so I think there's something to be learned from that, that the moral impulses of the country are not extinguished. They just need to be developed and coordinated and encouraged. And, this is still an ongoing struggle, and we don't know the outcome yet.
So important what you said about that the protests need to be organized. They need to be peaceful. And it is amazing to me the self-discipline that Americans have shown in this first year of Trump. It's almost like everybody got the memo, you know, that yes, come out into the streets in your millions,
yeah.
But don't throw rocks, don't break a window, don't leave trash. I mean, just make it a peaceful thing, because any violence on the part of the protesters will be used as a pretext for an even more vicious crackdown, and also will potentially alienate that middle voter that we're looking for to win over.
Yeah, you're quite right. That's really, really important. And you know, one of the models here is the civil rights movement in the late 50s
exactly.
and early 60s, and it's not the only model that one can look to. I know a person who's been involved in ministry, a very close friend of mine, who went to Minneapolis to express solidarity and to participate in the marches a few weeks ago. And it was very interesting talking to him about how well coordinated this whole thing was. And Minnesota, for reasons that are not entirely clear to me, has a kind of infrastructure of how to do these things. And so they were very, very careful on exactly the points that you raised, which is this has to be nonviolent. That was the coordination with the whistles, right? So people were going around blowing whistles when ICE forces showed up. There was instruction on how to protest and how not to protest. And it had a moral appeal that had a moral resonance with a lot of people. So again, I think now we kind of have a model where people can, you know, these things spread. And in new cities that are going to be attacked and targeted by Trump and his administration, they've got something to learn. I wanted to add one other thing, which I mentioned in the essay, Mona, that I think is important. And in the context of this is that there have been a lot of efforts, which I'm sure you're familiar with, I am too, of depolarization with America's mm-hmm. ability efforts to try and help us overcome our differences by learning to talk to each other in a way that can be, you know, you can hear each other and respect and civility. And I support those efforts. I've seen them in action. They can work at certain times. But I do think that what we've learned through Minneapolis and beyond that is the first order of business is that Trump has to be resisted and defeated. And then the depolarization can take place. But if you are dealing with a side that is being driven by a leader who has no interest in depolarization and every interest in dehumanization, you're operating on a false assumption. And there's nothing you can say or do to try and create understanding. And that is true, unfortunately, with a lot of the people who were followers. Truth and Reconciliation in South Africa, which was rightly held up as a model of how to heal a society, succeeded, but it only succeeded after the apartheid government was defeated. The moral appeals of Desmond Tutu or Nelson Mandela did not work until the apartheid regime had been defeated. Now, it's not that they can't be done at the same time, or again, you can't find places where these things make a difference and all of us should practice better, you know, understanding, listening better to each other than we do. So I do want to say that that's important. But I don't think you can lead with that in this moment. You have to understand what is happening on the ground. And right now, we have an administration that is being driven by malevolence, and they have to be defeated. And I think what we saw in Minneapolis was one step toward at least a temporary defeat.
I agree 100%. And as I discussed in a recent podcast with Ian Basson of Protect Democracy, who I know you know, you know, the thing that people can focus on and need to focus on is election security, because that is going to be, there's no doubt in my mind, I wonder if you agree, that they're going to attempt to thwart a free and fair election in 2026. Yeah. I don't know exactly how it's going to play out, whether they're going to try to lie about the results, whether they're not going to recognize actual results, whether they're going to send ICE agents out to polling places in blue cities and intimidate people from voting in the first place. All of these things are eminently possible, and that has to be our focus. We have to win these elections. It's critical.
Yeah. Now, as usual, I'm exactly where you are. And as usual, I'm very comforted by that fact. I have no question that they're going to do it too. I mean, this is not even speculative. They already tried it in 2020.
Exactly.
They just failed. And even that was closer than it should have been. And of course, now Trump has learned from that. He's obviously housed his administration with radicals, with people like Mike Pence and Bill Barr. And I'm not a particular fan of either one, but at least at that moment, when it really mattered with the election, they did do the right thing, and they should be praised for that. Well, those people don't exist now. So I think 2026, I have no question that they're going to try and turn the elections through illicit means to their favor. How that manifests itself, I don't know. And the things that you listed are very much on my list. Martial law could be, insurrection act could be at play too.
Trump also just nodded toward, he thought he made a mistake by not confiscating voting machines in 2020. He said that again. By the way, that would be a logistical impossibility, but still it's a threat. And he could do it in just one or two places, and that would be enough to swing the House, for example.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. It's a weird thing. That obsession, I mean, it does say something about the psychology of Donald Trump, and no one wants to spend too much time in that dark, dark world. But that election loss is the most obsessive thing that he has. It's why he keeps coming back to it time and time again. He would come back to it even when it wasn't in his political interest to do so. It's a driving thing. It's part of the vengeance campaign. It obviously goes to his malignant narcissism. So these elections matter a huge amount to him. He will do everything and anything he can to win, quote unquote, and there's nothing we know that would stop him. And the other thing that's at play here is it's not just him, but it's the people who work for him, because they know if they lose power, there may be a comeuppance that happens. So they're going to do everything in their power with no moral constraints at trying to rig the 2026. And I think particularly the 2028 election, they may be thinking of 2026 as a trial run to work out the kinks. But I think that has to be a huge focus, because if the elections can be legit, there's a chance that we can withstand Trump. Then if we do, there's an enormous amount of repair that has to happen. But you got to take a step at a time. And the first step is to begin to restrain and constrain the areas of damage he can do while he's president. And the most obvious way to do that is through Congress having some measure of checks and balances, and then within the agencies. But that's problematic because he's now got a vice grip on some of these key agencies, whether it's DOJ or elsewhere.
FBI. So I think it would probably be good for me to post in the show notes the links to places where people can volunteer for becoming election watchers or poll workers, or places you can donate where can help support attorneys who are going to bring lawsuits about the elections and whatever else I can think of, because people are always saying, what can I do?
Yes.
And there are millions of Americans who want to do something.
Right.
And there is a shortage of election workers right now because so many of them faced harassment and so forth in the last several cycles. And they tend to be older. So they think, why do I need this? So it would be particularly good if some young, vigorous people, I mean, it's nothing wrong with older people like me doing it. That's fine too. But it would be even better if some, good, strong young men and women are in there.
Amen. No, I think, getting the word out, that makes a big, big difference. These things can happen spontaneously. I just wanted, you mentioned something that I wanted to spend just 1 minute on, which is you talked about the people asking all the time, what can I do? This is something, and I'm wondering whether you experienced this too. I would say probably in the last 6 months in particular, the feelings of hopelessness and loss of human agency that I've heard from friends is beyond anything that I had heard before. It was as if one thing after another that was happening. There was this feeling that we're just sort of corks in the ocean. We can't do anything. And what Minneapolis showed is that people can do something. And I could tell just in conversations with different people that there was more of a spring in their step. It was a sense of saying, well, actually, there are things that can be done. And if you can't give this country and the citizens of this country can't give into despair, powerlessness. Vaclav Havel wrote this great essay in 1978, I think, called The Power of the Powerless. And of course, that was when Czechoslovakia was under communist control. And, he uses the illustration, the grocers, green grocers, and not putting up the propaganda signs in their windows. And, the Havel argument was, I'm going to live within the truth. I'm not going to live within the lie. And you can't live within the lie either. And if enough people don't live within the lie, that inspirits them, that gives them a sense of hope and purpose. So if you can take that sense, that impulse that I want to do something and then begin to channel it into concrete ways. That I think is really where the outcome can ultimately be decided in a positive way.
Well, I think that's a great place to end it. Thank you so much for joining me, Pete.
Great to be with you. Thanks for the conversation, Mona, and for all you're doing and for being faithful in the cause.
Likewise.